Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. After 18 months, COVID-19 vaccines are now available to some of the youngest Americans. Federal health officials authorized emergency use of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines for kids as young as 6 months. That translates to 2 million of the youngest Californians. This week, parents from Los Angeles to the Bay Area, Sacramento, and beyond headed to vaccination clinics for the initial 400,000 doses the state pre-ordered. But approval does not necessarily lead to confidence. There are still millions of parents across the country holding off. One study indicates that some hesitation is due to parents feeling there is a lack of information on how safe and effective vaccines are for children this young. So, to provide more details from a medical perspective, we've invited back Dr. Donald Alcindor, Associate Professor at Meharry Medical College and formerly with the FDA. Dr. Alcindor, welcome back to Insight. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
You know, given that you have such an important perspective with the FDA, can you refresh our listeners on the FDA approval process and really why it took so long for federal health officials to approve vaccines for children as young as 6 months old?
So a part of it is the clinical trials itself. So the clinical trials have to go through the different phases. And of course, then after the first, second, and third phase of the clinical trial, it has to go to a data safety monitoring board. And this is an overall look at the clinical data from individuals that are not associated with clinical trials or pharmaceutical companies. Then that information, after it goes to the Data Safety and Monitoring Board, goes to the FDA Advisory Committee. The FDA Advisory Committee basically overviews all of the information and looks at the recommendations by the Data Safety Monitoring Board. After that, the information goes, that is what the FDA Advisory Committee has said about the data, goes to the FDA for their approval. Usually the FDA will go along with the advisory committee recommendations unless there's some information that would suggest otherwise. After that, then you're looking at the FDA approval and subsequently guidance from the CDC. So the CDC advisory committee then looks at the data and makes a recommendation. And finally, the CDC head then approves the vaccine for distribution, in this case, emergency use authorization.
I mean, you're really laying out a lot of steps and layers to this. When it comes to the youngest group, children under five, what were the challenges over the last, you know, year or so or 18 months?
I think it was how young these children are. And of course, trying to find the right dosage that would provoke a robust immune response in these children. And then finding out how long this immune response would last. And of course, not knowing some children that may have been infected with COVID already, that complicates the matters as well. But again, finding the right dosage, in the case of Pfizer, you're talking about 3 micrograms of the antigen per dose of the mRNA vaccine. And with Moderna, you're looking at 25 microgram doses for those individuals. And of course, with both of the vaccine, you have to have multiple doses. So giving one dose and finding out where the immune response is after one, and then a subsequent dose, seeing if you get a robust boost in that immune response after the second dose. And it turns out for Pfizer, 2 doses of their vaccine at 3 micrograms per dose did not give them the kind of immune response they felt that would be beneficial to those children. And of course, subsequently, they decided to go with a third dose that gave them an efficacy of about 80.3%, something that they were looking for. And so again, this 3-dose regimen could be problematic for Pfizer because the idea is that parents will have to find a way to get their children vaccinated for 3 separate doses of the vaccine as opposed to 2 with the Moderna vaccine.
Are those the biggest differences between the 2 vaccines that have now have emergency use authorization, or are there other differences that parents should keep in mind?
So I just want people to understand that the mRNA vaccines were made to the original Wuhan strain of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. All of the vaccines that we have that are mRNA vaccines have been made to the spike protein of the original Wuhan strain of virus, meaning that the vaccines are not very different However, the dosages are. And so with Pfizer, they felt that a 3-microgram dose would give them the kind of response as opposed to the 25-microgram dose for Moderna. And so it is individually demonstrated by the different pharmaceutical firms that one dose works better than another, or one regimen works better than another with an mRNA antigen that is pretty much the same.
When it comes to vaccines, is it particularly challenging with this specific group? Because a 6-month-old developmentally is going to be very different than a 4-year-old. Does that lead to, I mean, I guess, is it more challenging than older groups, like older teenagers and even adults?
Yeah, it is challenging to even get them in the chair. First of all, when you're talking about children, you're really not talking about children, you're talking about the parents, and trying to establish a relationship with parents that have to make a very difficult decision in their minds. And many of them are getting misinformation and information that is not really correct in terms of complete correctness. And so they have, many of them have not seen children have a difficult time with this virus. And some of them don't know that 1,200 children have died within this age group, you know, as children, that is the 6 months to 17-year-olds, have died of COVID. And the idea is that we forget the importance of this vaccine being able to prevent any kind of severe disease in these children. And of course, we forget that there is multi-inflammatory syndrome that can occur in these children. Children also get long COVID as well. We also know that even though children are asymptomatic with COVID, they still can spread this infection to vulnerable populations. And of course, we also know that hospitalizations for children have increased tremendously due to the Omicron variant. And of course, if the virus is allowed to continue to replicate, you will have the continual emergence of new variants.
Are there side effects with either vaccine, Pfizer or Moderna, that parents should keep in mind for their children?
So they have looked at the rigors of these clinical trials, and what has come out of it is mild types of side effects that includes pain at the injection site, fever, chills, fatigue, and headache. And again, what they have not seen that most people were concerned about is the evidence of pericarditis or myocarditis in these young children that they've seen in some teenagers. And again, although rare, they have seen this with the mRNA vaccines of Pfizer and Moderna. However, they have associated with the second dose.
You know, you go back to the Wuhan strain, which was, you know, a couple of years ago, and now we have sub-variants that are more successful at kind of navigating around the protection that a vaccine would provide. There is some reporting that, or some studies that children, in terms of antibodies, have been exposed to COVID-19. If parents think that, okay, well, my child already had COVID, why do they need to be vaccinated? What is your response to that?
Yeah, so the idea of giving them an mRNA vaccine, what we've seen in adults is that there is a more robust immune response with a vaccination than with natural infection. And the idea is that people that have already been infected are recommended to get vaccinated as well for COVID-19. It is believed that a hybrid way of immune protecting yourself might be a better way. But again, we don't know if a hybrid immunization kind of approach where you get an acute natural infection and develop antibodies along with vaccination to develop antibodies, that it would be a hybrid event. And the idea, we don't know how long a hybrid type of vaccination or immune protection will last as well. But again, it is recommended that if you've been infected with COVID, we know that you can get a breakthrough infection. There are many people that have gotten the full course of the vaccine and fully boosted, and have had reinfections. And again, anytime you have a reinfection of COVID, you have a chance of developing severe disease. However, most individuals that have been fully vaccinated and boosted have had only mild disease when it comes to breakthrough infections.
Am I correct that for children, regardless of age, I think like 16 and under, the vaccines are only emergency use authorization?
That is correct. That is correct.
What, again, what if that makes some parents uncomfortable and they want to wait for full authorization? What do you want them to know, given that you formerly worked and consulted with the FDA?
Yes. And so when we look at all the vaccinations that have been out there, they came out as emergency use authorization. But when we look at the track record of these vaccinations being able to reduce the amount of severe disease and death in the general population, we have to say that when it comes to this EUA authorization, we expect that it would be a matter of time based on clinical trial data that these vaccines, even though for only emergency use authorization, would be fully approved within time. And the idea is that within time, they will learn more about these vaccines in the general population, as opposed to the 4,500 to 6,700 children within that age group that were in the original clinical trials.
You touched upon boosters for adults. Is there any research on when young children may need to get a booster or if it'll even be needed?
It is very clear that they may need boosters in the coming months. And the idea now is that they want to see how well the neutralizing antibodies will hold up in this young population over time. And the idea this could be different for young children with even within the short frame of that age group. So we might even see something different between 2 to 5, as opposed to 6 months to 2 years old, in terms of being able to hold on to neutralizing antibodies over time. And so boosters are certainly in the future for this age group, and it will only be a matter of looking at neutralizing antibodies in that population with ongoing studies to see how they hold up over time in terms of their protection received from the original regimen, 2 dose or 3 dose with the Pfizer vaccine.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Donald Alcindor about COVID vaccines for children under 5. A survey published last month by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that nearly 1 in 5 parents plan to get their young child vaccinated right away. That's about 20%. While nearly 40% said they would wait and see, 25% said they would definitely not. Given everything that we're talking about, do those numbers surprise you or don't they?
They don't surprise me. I'm embedded with vaccine programs on the ground, and I'm interacting with community partners, and I'm talking to them about their willingness to vaccinate these young children. Many of them are not. We even seen this same kind of hesitancy with pregnant women who were required to get the vaccine, but many of them are not. The concern is the concern we see for those that are 5 to 11, where you're looking at 29% of them are fully vaccinated in accordance with CDC right now. But when you look at 12 to 17, we see twice that, about 60% of them have been fully vaccinated. So what I'm saying is that you're looking at a mother that just had a 6-month-old, and the idea is that she wants to vaccinate them with COVID, probably has a lot of misinformation about COVID, and have developed a hard line when it comes to vaccine hesitancy, especially with a child so young. So what we have to do is get out, just like HHS is getting out now, with PSAs to support COVID-19 vaccination for these young children. And of course, we have to make an appeal to parents on a large scale that this is necessary. And we know that children can get COVID. They will be asymptomatic for the most part, but they can spread the infection to a vulnerable population. And of course, children can come down with severe disease and even die of COVID. And so I see going forward a significant vaccine hesitancy and of course, significant vaccine resistance. And so I expect from what we've seen here in Tennessee is that there would be significant hesitancy within rural communities. And of course, even in the vulnerable communities that are in inner cities as well.
In the past 18 months or so, year and a half that we've had vaccines available, have you experienced success stories in breaking through that hesitancy? And how can that kind of be broadened out across the country?
Yes, we have. And the idea is that we form collaboration with trusted partners within communities themselves. And the idea is that if you're talking to a pregnant mom who's likely to deliver relatively soon. A trusted messenger for her would be a person that is also pregnant, that have had the vaccine and can tell her that it didn't cause any problems for her. The other thing is that we try to reach communities where they are. And the idea is that having a person within the community that is trusted within that community to spread the word with correct information that's factual and that's based on CDC mitigation guidelines to protect that community. And of course, telling them what they need to know about the efficacy and safety of these vaccines. And what we know is that vaccines in general that have been approved by the FDA and sanctioned by the CDC for administration has been effective and safe for decades. Vaccines are among the most important, highly scrutinized public health interventions we have ever known. And the idea is that we live longer, in part to vaccines, than we did many years ago. And we know how protection is important when it comes to communicable diseases like COVID that is more infectious than measles, which is one of the most infectious virus infections that we know of.
Dr. Alcindor, thank you so much for the breakdown.
Thank you.
There's a lot to sort through. Dr. Donald Alcindor is an associate professor at Meharry Medical College and associate adjunct professor at Vanderbilt, explaining what parents need to know about COVID-19 vaccines for children as young as 6 months old. Up next, Sacramento City Council members are required to live in the district they serve, but the residency of one council member is being challenged. The journalist who sparked the inquiry joins us. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Insight comes from DeCamilla Capital Management, an independent investment advisor and strict fiduciary, delivering clarity and understanding for retirement and personal investors for more than two decades. Learn more at DeCamillaCapital.com.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. California law requires city council members to live in the district they serve, given they're elected to represent residents in a hyper-local position. If they move outside the area, that seat can become vacant, among other consequences. In the city of Sacramento, Councilmember Sean Lalowie's residency is being called into question following an exclusive report from the Sacramento Bee. Councilmember Lalowie represents District 2, which encompasses Del Paso Heights, Hagenwood, and North Sacramento, which are some of the most disadvantaged neighborhoods in the city. Lalowie initially agreed to come on Insight when the first article was published on Friday, but we've been unable to reach him since. However, he did send us a statement that Friday saying, as an active city council member and businessman in the greater Sacramento region, it's not a stretch to believe that a random two-week period of time chosen by a newspaper would not accurately represent the full picture of my life and does not account for the necessary measures I've taken to protect my family. The city of Sacramento has documented and verified my residence, and I will continue to proudly represent the people of Council District 2. Joining us now is the journalist whose reporting is sparking a larger inquiry, Teresa Clift with the Sacramento Bee. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Vicki.
Let's start with a background on Council Member Lalowie for those who don't live in his district or even the city of Sacramento.
Sure. Councilmember Lalloy is a owner of a small grocery store chain that has two locations in North Sacramento, a location in Dixon and a location in Rancho Cordova. He's opened grocery stores in food deserts, areas that don't have access to fresh food, which he really campaigned on that. He also used to have a grocery store chain, I believe, in the Bay Area that had the same mission. He is an immigrant, and he tells me that he lives in Del Paso Heights. That he lives in Hagenwood for the last several years with his wife and two children.
How long did the council member live in the district that he serves? I mean, this is his first term as council member.
Yeah, he says that he has lived in the house in Hagenwood since about 2017, and that he had it built, which it was built in 2017. Records show he actually bought it in 2019, which was a few months before he filed paperwork to run for city council.
When did you begin questioning his residency?
When he was sworn in to city council, it was during coronavirus, so it was virtual, as the meetings still are. So all of the members were in their homes or offices. And this was back in December 2020, after he defeated longtime Councilman Alan Warren for the seat. And at that time, the video showed him in a house that looked very spacious with very high ceilings and a fireplace. And immediately my phone was blowing up from a lot of people saying that does not look like it's in the district. Like you mentioned, it's a pretty low income district with some of the city's poorest neighborhoods. And rumors started flying right immediately that night that maybe he doesn't live there. However, when I checked with the clerk back then, she explained that the process the city goes through to verify that a council member lives in the district is to make sure they've lived there at least 30 days by checking the voter registration that's filed with the county. And at the time, she was not disclosing the address, but could verify that they did indeed verify that he lives in the district according to his voter registration. And I also spoke with him a few months later. He explained that he lived in Hagenwood, his wife's property in Granite Bay was just an investment property, not where his family was living. At that time it seemed, to be, the truth that he lived in the district. And, However, the rumors continued, so I decided to look into it farther.
And what did that entail?
I obtained the address where he says he lives and where he's registered to vote from some activists and independent journalists, and was able to go visit the house several times. I was able to speak to neighbors of the house from three different households on the street who said they'd never seen Sean Lalloy. And on the last visit, I visited after a council meeting ended, and that time I met a Latino man at the home who said he lived there with his son as a renter from Sean.
Okay, so it potentially could be a rental. There's a photo of the property as well. There were several cars on the property. When you brought all that to Councilmember Lalloy, what was his response?
Yeah, I mentioned that there's roughly a dozen vehicles on the property and a mini excavator. Some of the vehicles didn't have license plates and some were parked in the yard on grass, which is actually a code violation that some people face hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines for in his district. He told me that the vehicles were left there from a previous tenant that he had in the house for several months while he moved his family to Robla, which is also in the district, because the Hagenwood house was spray painted.
Hmm. When you brought up, you know, the potentially the discrepancy of where he was sworn in, what did he tell you going back to December of 2020?
He says that he has lived in the house in Hagenwood since 2017, except that stretch of a few months when he moved the family to a house in Robla. He declined to give the address of the house in Robla, and county records show he doesn't own any other residential properties in the city. However, he still says that he moved for a period of time to Robla, and that during the once a decade redistricting process that the city went through, Robla, part of Robla was put into District 1, and that was the part that the house he was staying in with his wife and children was in. And so when that happened, he moved the family back to the Hagenwood house, evicted the tenants that were there. And that is when, that is why all those vehicles are still there, because he's giving them a few more weeks to get the vehicles out.
Going back to when he was sworn in, though, were you able to confirm, is that connected to the house in the district that he serves?
Yeah. When I interviewed him last week, I asked about the house where he was sworn in with the fireplace. And he told me that was a friend's house in the Fab 40s neighborhood of East Sacramento. However, since then, I've found a previous real estate listing for the Granite Bay house that appears to show the same house where he was sworn in, meaning that it actually was not in the Fab 40s in East Sacramento, that he was actually sworn in his wife's Granite Bay house.
Did he respond to that?
He did not directly respond to that when I called him back this week and presented him with a listing and with that information. He did not directly respond to that. He said it's nobody's business where he was sworn in, and he repeated that he lives in District 2.
Because Granite Bay is not only outside of the city, it's in a different county.
That's right. Granite Bay is known as the most affluent city in the region. And so residents in specifically in Del Paso Heights, which is one of the most disadvantaged neighborhoods in the city, believe that he can't understand their plight and their issues if he lives outside the district, especially if he lives in Granite Bay.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with SACB reporter Teresa Clift about her reporting on Sacramento City Council member Sean Lalowe, whose residency in the district he serves is being called into question following Teresa's reporting. What is the city saying about this, his colleagues on the city council, or even the mayor?
The mayor has asked Sean to provide a public report of some sort during a council meeting that explains where he's living and where he moved, where he moved and when. And it's unclear when that will happen. It's not expected to happen at Tuesday's meeting. However, perhaps it could happen later on in July. Either Mayor Steinberg or City Manager Howard Chan have the ability to place an item on an agenda. And some members of the community are calling upon the council to take a vote to vacate the seat. However, it's unclear if there's an appetite for that at this time.
All right. So that could be potentially one consequence. I mean, you also talked with election legal experts. What other consequences could the council member face if it is determined that he does not live in the district that he serves?
There is a mechanism under state law if the aside from the council having the ability to vacate the seat, there is a mechanism where residents of the district could file what's called a quo warranto lawsuit. I believe that would have to go through the AG's office in order to attempt to remove him from the seat if they feel like they're not being represented. And then on the issue of potential voter fraud, Sean has voted in three elections since registering to vote at the Hagenwood House, including earlier this month. And if it is in fact true that he does not live there, that he rents the house out, that some folks are saying that that could potentially be voter fraud, but that would have to come from the DA's office as a criminal charge, and he would be able to remain on city council unless convicted.
The next city council meeting is Tuesday. What will you be paying attention to? What could potentially happen?
To be honest, I don't expect this to come up too much on Tuesday. It barely came up this week, this week's council meeting. But the agenda will be out later today, so we will see if there will be anything on this at that time.
Thank you so much, Teresa.
Thank you.
Teresa Clift is a reporter with the Sacramento Bee. Up next, Sacramento's Crocker Museum kicks off its summer jazz series tonight, and we have the star of tonight's program next. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Vivian Lee, she is Sacramento's very own queen of jazz.
Hey, little girl, comb your hair, fix your makeup. Soon he will walk through the door. Don't think because there's a ring there on your finger, you needn't try anymore. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. I'm warning you.
Everyone is swaying in here in both booths. That track is called Wives and Lovers. And tonight, Vivian will be teaming up with a group of her friends for a performance at Sacramento's Crocker Art Museum for an unforgettable evening of jazz. All you need to do is bring a lawn chair and be ready to enjoy the likes of Duke Ellington, Gershwin, among others. Vivian Lee joins us now to talk more about her musical journey here in Sacramento and tonight's concert, which kicks off Sacramento's longest running summer jazz series. Vivian Lee, thank you for taking the time to join us today. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin with tonight's performance. For people who might not be familiar with the Crocker Museum summer jazz series, explain to our listeners what they can expect.
Well, they can expect a lot of music, some great food, because they have a nice menu out in their courtyard. And just a beautiful evening. The trees are around, and it's in the back courtyard, and they set it up theater style, as well as people being able to sit in their lawn chairs around. And it's just, it's wonderful. It really is. I really enjoy always going there to play.
The performance is actually called Vivian Lee and Friends. So tell us who your friends are and how you all came together for tonight's performance.
Well, my friends are Beth Duncan, who's another jazz vocalist, wonderful vocalist here in town, as well as a person that's on Insight sometimes, Carol Manson, another wonderful vocalist, and Darius Babazadeh, who is a tenor sax player extraordinaire here in town.
That's right. Beth Duncan has been a fill-in host here on Insight, and we actually have an example of Beth's music. We're going to take a quick listen to her song, I Thought About You.
I took a trip on a train, and I thought about you. I passed a shadowy lane, and I thought about you. Two or three cars parked under the stars, a winding stream. Moon shining down on some little town, and with each beam, you know it's the same old dream. And every stop that we made, oh, I thought about you. And then I pulled down the shade, that's when I really got blue. I peeked through the crack and looked at the track, the one going back to you. And what did I do? I thought about you.
What a wonderful voice. When did you and Beth first connect?
Oh, my gosh. I met Beth, I think, in 2003 when we first started the Sunday Evening Jazz. We started over at the Stock Market, and I had not heard her. She was recommended for us to book her, and we booked her, and I was sitting there in the side taking money at the door and just really blown away. She's just such a wonderful person, too.
I imagine the roots of jazz in Sacramento and knowing each other, they go pretty deep.
Yes, there's a whole, yeah, it's a big family. The jazz family in Sacramento is huge. There's a lot of us, vocalists and instrumentalists, and we just always are crossing paths, and it's wonderful.
You know, given that Crocker Art Museum Summer Jazz Series, and I just learned this yesterday, that it's the longest running Summer Jazz Series, when did you start taking part in it?
I think the first time I played back in the courtyard was like 2015, I think, was when I connected with Stacey Shelnut Hendricks.
Wow, so that's about 7 years, not to mention throwing in a pandemic. How much has changed? I would imagine tonight has a deeper meaning for you, and you're especially excited for it.
Oh, my goodness, yes. it's like old home. I'll get to see. Some of my fans have already written me and said, see you tonight. And I'm looking forward to seeing them. Some of them I have not seen in 2.5 years. And, you know, we crossed paths, Beth and I and Carol and Darius, we crossed paths over these last 2.5 years. But to get to share a stage and for us all to play together, it's going to be wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, we know for the past 2.5 years, especially like the first year going into the pandemic, how it really was just a hard stop for artists and creativity who love to perform and share with others. How did that serious hard stop? Yeah, how did that shape you?
It made me reassess a lot of things that, you know, in my musical life and just in my life, I sat back. I wrote a lot of charts. I practiced a lot on my own. And just really reassessed where I want to go with my music and how I want to take the direction I want to take it in and everything.
Yeah, it was kind of an evolution that maybe wasn't desired, but you rolled with it.
It lets you stop and just kind of smell the roses, as they say, and just see just what you want to do. Because when you're in it and you're playing all the time, you're just going full bore and just doing it, you know. But when you have that moment where you have to stop, you can really look around and see exactly what you want to do.
Yeah, that pause really allows for reflection. And given that you've said that you're a storyteller through your music and performances, give us an example of what that means.
For me, what I do, and I told the guys yesterday when I was talking with them, my family and my boyfriend, I ask them all the time, were your ears burning? Because I use them sometimes in my stories to build up to the song. And one thing, the song that comes to mind is a song called Some Other Time. And it's about being with someone that you love, be it a relative or a boyfriend or a spouse, and not having enough hours in the day to spend with them. You've been having a wonderful day, and it's the end of the day. And for me, it's the end of a time where I have to get on the plane and come back to Sacramento from Detroit. And so some other time, it means something to me and to anybody who's spending time with someone that, and then I look out in the audience and see how it's affecting them after I've kind of set up the words and then I sing the lyrics. And it's wonderful to look and see the reaction that people have of what it means for them in their lives.
When did jazz first begin for you?
Well, jazz has always been in my life because my father had every album known to man stuffed in our console TV stereo side. But for me, actually enjoying straight-ahead jazz came around 1995, 94, when I started singing, because I didn't really start singing until I was 38 years old. And I listening to KXJV, I heard Blossom Deary and some other instrumentals, and I'm like, you know what? This music is actually pretty cool. I think I like this. And so that started my journey.
38 years old, what led to that? What led to that journey and pivoting and becoming a vocalist?
Doing a Christmas party when I was still in the Air Force, we would do variety shows. Hospital people are a little bit different. And we would do variety shows, and someone suggested that I sing these Billie Holiday tunes at our Christmas party. And I, first time I ever sung in front of anyone, got up, I did it, and people loved it. And I was like, okay, this sounds like fun. And I just, from that point on, I just started honing my skills. I'm like, I'm having a good time. I don't know what I can do with this, but let's see what I can do with it. And then here I am, you know, 28 years later.
And with that, you have several awards. You've received dozens of accolades. And I think within that is also a story that a lot of people can resonate with, that there's really, you can start at any time.
Oh, you can. You know, I never knew I had a voice. As I was telling the guys the other day, I grew up in the Catholic Church, folk choir. I did not grow up in the church singing in a choir like so many other vocalists do. And so I didn't know I had a voice. And I discovered it at 38 years old. Mm.
You've also collaborated with some of the best in the business. What moments resonate with you as highlights?
Doing my last CD, when Jeff Clayton of the Clayton Brothers Quintet, a well-known musician, he would mentor me. He lived here in Sacramento for a few years, and he mentored me, and he was a wonderful friend. And on my latest CD is a song called Emily, and he played on that. And it was the last time we played together. He passed away in 2020. And I hear that song, and it just hits my heart because I miss my friend, and I hear what he did, and it was so beautiful. And so that's the one point that resonates for me.
Yeah, I mean that kind of just deepens the power of connection, having that musical connection and relationship.
Yes, it does.
So when it comes to tonight, what style of jazz is on the playlist?
Well, I like to find obscure songs, and I like to find songs that that are traditionally instrumental but I'll hunt around until I find someone that's written words to it. Like Night in Tunisia, Ella Fitzgerald did that. There are several different sets of lyrics, and I use the lyrics that she did. There's a Bud Powell tune called Strictly Confidential that I found lyrics to. That's going to be on the playlist. Waltz for Debbie, a Bill Evans tune. So there's a lot of fun stuff. Beth is going to do a little bit of blues. I have no idea what Darius Bob of the Day is going to do. And Carol's got a beautiful ballad, Skylark, on her playlist. So we're just going to have a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. Seems like that. There's a wide variety and also just a lot of talent. What's in store for you for the rest of the summer?
The rest of the summer, I have a few park concerts for some of the councilmen. I do a concert in my backyard, and I am going to be doing that. It's my 68th birthday celebration. I'm not ashamed to tell how old I am. And I'm actually bringing the lady out from Detroit that I met last year, and she's going to come out and share that show with me.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much, Vivian, for joining us
tonight.
Thank
you for having me.
And I know you're going to have a great time, and I'm just happy that things are picking up again.
Yeah, I am too.
Vivian Lee is performing tonight at Sacramento's Crocker Museum, kicking off its Summer Jazz Concert Series. You can find a link for tickets at capradio.org. Just head to the Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, if you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez, as well as Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday. But in the meantime, here is more of Vivian Lee, Waltz for Derby.
Clowns and a prince and a big purple bear. Liz, my favorite girl, unaware of the worried frowns that we weary grown-ups all wear. In the sun she dances to silent music, songs that are spun of gold somewhere in her own little head. Someday, all too soon, she'll grow up and she'll leave her dolls and her prince and her silly old bear. When she goes, they will sigh as they whisper goodbye. They will miss her, I fear, but then so will I. Sweet world, populated by dolls and clowns and the prince and a big purple bear. Lives my favorite girl, unaware of the worried frowns that we weary grown-ups all wear. In the sun, she dances to silent music, songs that are spun of gold somewhere in her own little head. Someday, all too soon, she'll grow up and she'll leave her dolls and her prince and her silly old bear. When she goes, they will sigh as they whisper goodbye. They won't miss her, I fear, but then so will miss her, I fear, but then so will miss her, I fear, but then so will.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.